Yeah, great to be here with you young folks. I do. It's easy to forget that you used to be young. But I'm doing well at age 82, except for your allergies, which are bothering me. But I, pardon me, I'm delighted to be able to come and talk with you. Basically, I'm going to be talking with you tonight and tomorrow about three lessons that I do from the wisdom literature. And our lesson tonight will mostly be centered on the book of Ecclesiastes. And I have kind of a particular and personal way of looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. But what the book is about is, what profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? So, at my age, it's time to kind of reflect a little on that question. Whenever Jeff asked me to come and do this and reflect some on I was once young, but now I'm old, and I look back on my life and what is life all about, that's what the book of Ecclesiastes is about. And next month, I am going to Nashville to the Christian Scholars Conference, it's called, which is a meeting of scholars mostly out of at Churches of Christ, out of the Restoration tradition, but generally others there as well. And this year, I am being honored at the conference by a Feshrif, which is a book. I'll say in the first place, I have been reflecting about my life because this is a book written partly by my PhD students. A number of my PhD students have articles in it, and a number of the leading church historians in the country. And so they have articles about me in there. And I think some of them understand me somewhat, and some of them don't. But the interesting thing about the book is none of them doubt how faith has been the center of my life and of my historical career as well. And so I'm delighted with that. This is the concluding article by a woman named Beth Barton Swager, who teaches at the University of Arkansas, where I once taught, and recommended her to take my place, and so she's much beholden to me. But she concludes with an article on the very civil faith of David Edwin Harrell, Jr. Now, in many ways, what these people are most interested in is how I could be so openly what I am, and so forthrightly have a simple view of what life is about, and at the same time be a prolific writer. Richard Hughes, I don't know if any of you have read much Restoration history, but Richard Hughes is one of the leading scholars in the area of American Restoration history, and has also been a longtime friend of mine. And he says in his article, Harold knows precisely who he is. He movingly explained his powerful sense of self to a rapt audience gathered at Abilene Christian University in 1988. That very sense of self is determined not only who he is as a man, but also who he is as a historian. And that sense of self has everything to do with his restoration vision. Now, I will just tell you then that the first clue to having a life that is rich and full and that is faithful is figure out who you are and to figure out what you believe. And that really is what the book of Ecclesiastes is about. It is about how in the midst of life, and which is full of uncertainty and vanity and vexation of spirit, how can we find meaning for ourselves? Now, in my reading of the book of Ecclesiastes, it's not a systematic book that goes from point A to point D. It is a book that considers, however, a number of different answers to the question of how do we figure out what life is all about? And how can I be sure that my life is worthwhile? And I believe that the book of Ecclesiastes offers four answers. Three that the writer, who I presume is Solomon, discards as inadequate and useless. The first is the way of wisdom. In chapter 1, verse 16, he introduces this for the first time. I communed with mine own heart, saying, lo, I'm come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that are before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. I gave my heart to know wisdom, and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit, and that in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. So the first way that this book presents that I can come to terms with, okay, how can I have a good life? What is life about? The first answer that's suggested is, well, the answer is to surely become wise. And if there is any way to have a good life, it surely is to learn what the great minds of our time have to say. And I tell you, of course, I've been involved in that all my life, having taught in universities for 55 years. Most of the people there were pretty persuaded that the only way to reach the answer to the question of what should I do with my life is to become wise and to become like them. But what the book of Ecclesiastes tells us is that that ends with vanity and vexation of spirit. As he said, I considered all the options that are out there, a lot of options in the world for how should you live your life. And he said, I looked at all of them, and I even gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. That verse always intrigued me because when I first started teaching many years ago, I had a good friend who was a philosopher, and he was very bright. He was so bright that he was kind of crazy. But he said to me one day, we were talking seriously, and he said, Ed, he said, I tell you, I have decided that the only people that really understand life are crazy people. And I thought about that for a little while. I tell you what will give some credence to that. If you'll just sit around and watch sane people, you may come to conclude that it is crazy people that understand life, because sane people do so many crazy things. But what Solomon says is, he says, you won't find the answer to the question of, well, what should I do with my life through some wise man. It's kind of one of my favorite cartoons that I cut out years ago. Have you ever heard the old nonsense joke of the young man who wanted to find out the meaning of life? So he had this favorite professor, and he went to the professor and he said, Professor, what is the meaning of life? And the professor said, well, I don't know. He said, but I will tell you, he said, I studied with the most brilliant man in the world, in Germany, and if anybody knows the answer to the question, he probably knows. So this young fella sold some of his goods and went to Germany and found this professor and went to him and said, Professor, he said, what is the meaning of life? And the professor said, oh, well, I don't know the answer to that. He said, but he said, if there is any answer, he said, there is a guru high in the Himalayas who is the wisest and most spiritual man I've ever known? And if anybody knows the answer to that question, surely he knows. So this is the guru. So this young man sold everything that he had and spent all his money, went to India, climbed up the mountain in the Himalayas, found the guru and said, "What is life?" And the guru said, "Life is a river." And this young man said, "Wait a minute." He said, "You mean I sold everything I had and spent all my money and came over here and climbed up this mountain, and you tell me life is a river?" And the guru said, "You mean life isn't a river?" Okay. So, I can tell you, whatever you do and wherever you go and whoever you ask, he doesn't know. So you can try to find the wisest person in the world that you know and ask him to try to tell you the answer to the question of what is life. So you can ask the wisest fellow that you know in Houston, and I can tell you, I've spent a lot of time with him. He doesn't know. So, if you're trying to answer the question, well, what should I do with life? And you say, well, I'll find some philosopher that knows. I'll tell you a story about D. I'll have to not divert to tell you too many stories. But D and Norma and my wife and I traveled in Europe this past year, as we have on a number of occasions, and since we're very good friends. And as usual, well, I drove us through France and Belgium and Netherlands, which was hard. It's hard to drive through Paris. And every time we came to a fork, we had five different opinions about which way we ought to go, because there were four of us, and I also had a GPS. So finally, my wife and Norma and Dee would talk all the time, and I couldn't hear the GPS. So finally I told them, be quiet so I can listen to this GPS, because I'm believing it and not you about where to go. So I finally got them quiet. But every time I'd get them quiet, Dee would start whistling. And I still couldn't hear. So finally I said, okay, D, cut the whistling out. And he said, you all know D. D said, oh, wait, I'm sorry, Ed. He said, I was just trying to cheer everybody up. And I said, it's not working. So anyhow, D's a great man. But if you're looking for the answer to the question, what should I do with my life through wisdom, you won't find it. Well, the second thing that's proposed in the book of Ecclesiastes is the way of materialism, that what life is about is to have fun, right? As I said, I've taught for 55 years in universities. I never did find many young people looking for wisdom. I found a lot of them looking for fun. I said in my heart, go to now, I'll prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see that which was good for the sons of men, which they should do unto heaven all the days of their life. Now, that is actually the American way of life. That what most people think life is all about is, well, what we need to do is we just need to enjoy it as much as we can and have fun. And most people don't do a very good job of that. I've sat in our faculty coffee room lots of times on a Monday morning, and everybody would be sitting around the table, and saying, oh, you should have been with us this weekend. Boy, did we have fun. We all got dead drunk, and what a party we had. And they are all sitting there, and they look like one of those cartoon characters whose heads are about to crack open and about to bleed to death from their eyes. And I would always try to pound on the table a little to see if I could help that. Most people, they think, well, what life's about is having fun. Live it up. They don't enjoy life. They make wrecks out of their life. And so that is easy to discard, that there's no profit under the sun if you just see it as a matter of, well, I'm going to enjoy myself and have a good life. That actually is not even what he's proposed in the second chapter when he introduces this. He really proposes a life of accomplishment and enlightenment. That what life is about is accomplishing things and doing great things. And the writer said, I made me great works, built me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made me gardens and orchards and pools of water. He says, I was a patron of the arts. I gathered men and women singers, and I was great. And surely that is what life is about. Now, we're going to see in just a minute, I believe where this book concludes is that it is fine for us to live life fully and do the best we can and accomplish whatever we can. I have to tell you, I've never been very oriented toward goals. I've just tried to set out and do the best I could at the things I did and let it come out where it would. But if what your life is nothing except what you gain and have and accomplish, the book of Ecclesiastes gives us a number of reasons why that is not a satisfactory way of life. So I want to suggest to you that you need to be careful, and tomorrow and the two other lessons that I have from the wisdom literature, what will be quite clear is that if all we have is just the things that we accomplish on earth, then our lives will be pretty empty. The third proposal that is made in the book of Ecclesiastes is what I call the way of a skeptic. You remember this passage, and you know that the Beatles, I think it was, made famous with their song, "To everything there's a season, a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together again." Verse 9, "What profit hath he that worketh, and that wherein he laboreth?" That's really, philosophically, that's existentialism. That if you ask the question of what's life all about, the answer is, well, it's not about anything. We're just here. And things happen. And you, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. You're born, you die. One generation piles stones up in one place, and the next generation throws them away. One generation builds a great city, and the next generation destroys it. Now, if that is true, that's actually the worst answer of all. And he says that at the beginning of the fourth chapter. "So I return and consider all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. Wherefore I praise the dead which are already dead more than the living which are yet alive. Yea, better is he than both they which have not yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that's done under the sun." Now, what is life all about if it is just that we're animals who happen to become intelligent enough that we can think about it and view it, and it has no meaning? Just things happen. Good things happen, bad things happen. And he said, of all the answers that I've given, that's the worst answer. That if you consider that, if that's so, and you see all the bad things, you ever see anything bad happen that you can't understand? Yeah, a lot of things. He says, if that's true, it'd be better off to be dead than to be alive. And he said, in fact, it'd be better to have never been born and not seen the evil that's done than to imagine that we are nothing except to go through this experience. Okay, now quickly, let me suggest to you the fourth way that's proposed in the book of Ecclesiastes to deal with the question of what is life all about and what should I be doing? And I have to tell you, when I get to this point, my life has been so simply directed. I mean, we'll get that filled out a little bit in these lessons. But I don't have any complicated answers whatsoever to the question of why have you done the things that you've done in life? My answers are actually quite simple. And the beginning of it is, in Ecclesiastes, the fifth chapter, in the first two verses, there's a passage that I believe for the first time presents the answer that says, if you want to have meaning for your life, here is what you'll have to do, and here's where you'll find it. Keep thy foot when thou goest into the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. Be not rash with thy mouth, and let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God's in heaven and thou upon earth. Therefore, let thy words be few. Now, I will tell you, if you ask the question, what is life all about, and how should I live my life, I will tell you the result will be everybody starts talking. Nobody knows, but everybody starts talking. And too often, people listen to the worst voices. Another one of my favorite cartoons that I didn't put on here was a cartoon of a marriage counselor talking to a couple sitting there. And the caption is, "Oh, yes," he said, "I understand your problem. That's the same thing that broke me up with my fourth wife." So, I don't know how we go. You know, we go to our neighbor that's a wreck, or we go to Oprah or somebody on TV to find the answer to the question, what does life mean? And nobody knows. So he says, I will tell you what you need to do. If you want to find meaning for your life, you need to shut up and be quiet, because you won't know. I used to have a friend when I taught at the University of Georgia who was probably like a friend that you had. I used to know a guy that knew everything. It did not make any difference what you were talking about. Charlie knew all about it, and he'd tell you all about it. And I told one of my other friends one day, I said, I tell you, Charlie's problem is he greets every question with an open mouth. And that is the way most people live their lives. But what the book of Ecclesiastes proposes for us, if you want to find meaning for your life, and if you want to have a good life, what you need to do is be quiet and listen to God. Because God's in heaven and you're on earth, and therefore we need to be quiet. Now, let me just quickly tell you that I believe if you do that, if you have an absolute kind of faith and trust in God's instructions for us. You can have a good life. That's absolutely been at the heart of my existence, is to say what I'm going to do is listen to God. And there are really two planks in it. Number one is to believe it, and number two is to do it. And that's what we'll be seeing repeatedly in these lessons. And if you do that, in verse 8 of chapter 5, he says, if thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of judgment and justice in a province, marvel not at the matter, for he that's higher than the highest regard is, and there be higher than they. All right, there's some question about translation of that verse, but I like this translation. And I believe what it says is this. If you ever see something happening in the world in your lifetime that you don't like, and I can tell you, you'll see a lot of things you don't like. You'll see troubles in the world. I mean, when I was your age, we were in the middle of the Cold War. And, you know, we had people building bomb shelters that would have done absolutely no good. But they, you wonder when the world goes wrong, you say, well, what can I do about this? And I thought several times, well, maybe what I need to do is I need to write a letter to the premier of the Soviet Union and say, now, if you really get mad at the United States, please don't shoot a bomb at Birmingham, which was where I was living. because it would inconvenience me. But that probably wouldn't do any good. So what can you do when you see things that are out of your control? All you have to do is turn the news on every night, and I'll see something I don't like. So does that worry you? I know a lot of people just fret their way through life because of that. Well, I don't do that because he that's higher than the highest regard is, and there be higher than they. I'll tell you what I don't control and what nobody else controls. God controls. And so I don't have to worry about it. That takes a big load off my back. But it does at a personal level, too. Years ago, I was in a meeting, and I went home to eat with a young couple one day. And some of the other people asked me later, they said, did they tell you about their little girl? I said, no, they didn't. And they told me a story. It's just the tragedy of tragedies, that this young couple had an 8-year-old daughter who had come home from school one day healthy and the next morning was dead. And that young woman, when she could say anything about it, said something that deeply impressed them and me. She said, I don't understand it, but all I can say is that heaven means more to me now than it ever could have meant before. Now, I'm going to tell you, some bad things will happen to you in life. And if somebody comes along and tells you, oh, well, if you're going to be a Christian, you'll have a lot of difficulties and troubles. If you're a human being, you're going to have a lot of difficulties and trouble. Everybody has troubles and difficulties. A Christian is somebody that knows how to accommodate that and to live with it so that you can live with life at its worst. That whatever happens, I have a deep confidence that God knows and He cares and that it will be right. So you can live it a lot. You can live your life at its worst. I've had bad things happen in my life. But in many ways, the theme of the book of Ecclesiastes is not only that if we put God at the head of our lives and say, I'm going to trust him, absolutely. Then whatever happens, if something bad happens, I can live with that. But also, if I do that, I can have a good life. There's nothing wrong with enjoying life and appreciating it and being thankful for the things that God gives us. He actually returns to that theme repeatedly in the book. Chapter 2, 24, there's nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who else can hasten hitherto more than I? Or chapter 5, verse 18, behold, that which I've seen, it's good and comely for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of his labors, that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life. I will tell you what God has provided for us. God has provided a lot of good things for us. You got anything in life that's worthwhile? Anything to enjoy? I will tell you what happens to most people in life. Most people don't live their life because they're chasing life. And that's what, I'll tell you, the worst thing that television does to you. Television does a lot of bad things to you. It dumbs you down, and it undermines our morality. But I'll tell you, the worst thing television does to you is it sells you a set of values. And the set of values it sells you are those of some filthy-minded advertising man on Madison Avenue who wants to sell you something. And what he tells you is that there's only one way to be happy in life, and that is if you're young and if you're rich and if you're pretty. And I ain't any of those. And so, and never was but one, and that was young. And so you can say, man, what's going on here? I'm missing life. It's awfully easy for a fellow to be sitting in his easy chair watching TV, seeing this beautiful young girl splashing through the seashore with her hair streaming out behind her and looking across the room to see his wife in her hair curlers and bathrobe saying, man, I'm missing life. No, you're not missing life. That's not life. That's an illusion. And what you need to do is you need to enjoy life. If you have anything that's worth enjoying, he says, I've got plenty to eat. I've got plenty to eat at home. I've got all the country ham and grits I can eat, and you can't do any better than that. He said, who can eat better, more than I can? And I've got a good bed. You can have a house with 12 bedrooms in it, but you can't sleep in but one at a time. So he says, what you need to do is you need to learn to enjoy the things that you have. Years ago, I remember driving down, when I first moved to Birmingham, Alabama, driving down the richest street in town. And it was kind of in the mountains, and there's mansions on both sides. And I had five children. My wife and I had five children. All five children piled in the back end of the station wagon. And all you could hear coming out of the back end of that station wagon was somebody say, oh, look at that one up there. And somebody say, ooh, look at that one down there, looking at those big houses. And I said, yeah. I said, don't you imagine those people living in those houses are probably the happiest people in this town? Well, they probably were not. And most of them, the husband probably had stomach ulcers and the wife was an alcoholic and all the children were hippies. And they probably weren't happy at all. And if they were happy, it wasn't because they were having those things. So he says, I will tell you what you need to do is you need to, it God gave you the right to live fully and enjoy your labors. So don't fight life. Live it. Or it'll pass you by and you'll miss it. So that's the advice of the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, the book does suggest in several places that, well, is that it? Isn't there more to life than just that? And the answer is, yeah, there is. He says for the first time, I think, in chapter 3 and verse 11, he has made everything beautiful in his time. And by the way, that's a great remark. If you get your head on straight and say, I just want to live life and be thankful to God for the things that he's given me, everything has its own beauty, good times and bad times. I've been through some hard times that have been good for me. So you need to see the beauty as you go along. But then he says also he has set the world in their heart. And I believe that that's the first time that the writer of Ecclesiastes looks up and says, no matter how you live your life, you're compelled to think about, where did I come from? And how did I get here? And what does it mean? And so he said the final thing that we need to look at is, why am I here? And, of course, that's where the book of Ecclesiastes ends up. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in another lesson. But he ends up with this admonition. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. I'll tell you what the book of Ecclesiastes ends with. There are two obligations that'll give meaning to your life. Number one is to fear God and put God in his place and have faith in him. You know what fear means? When I read that passage, I said, you know, I need to look at what fear means. It's used 47 times in the New Testament, used 317 times in the Old Testament. And I'll tell you what I believe it means. I believe what fear means is fear. It means that we need to stand in awe of God and say, I'm going to live my life in accord with his directions. And that's the second part of this admonition, that if we're looking for general directions about how should I live my life, it's get God in his place and say, I'm going to treat him like God and put my trust in him. And then I am going to do what God tells me to do. And I will just close our lesson this evening by saying that I've been amazed kind of in looking back through my life how that's just always been in place. That I've run into a lot of intellectual elites in my life. It'd be easy to capitulate to them. But if you fear God and say, I'm going to keep his commandments, you don't have to do that. You don't have to become a moral relativist in a politically correct world. A lot of people have asked me, how do you get by with holding those convictions and holding them so openly in the academic world? And I'll talk with you about that a little bit in some of the other lessons. But I have been very forthright about my faith. I've been chairman of two major history departments in the country. And this book, it's interesting in this book that nobody questions that open commitment of faith. They all wonder how and why. But you don't have to, you don't ever have to compromise your faith in God. I don't try to offend people, but neither have I ever felt a need to try to hide anything that I believe. So we'll look at that some more. And you can say, well, is life that simple? Yeah, I believe it's that simple. That it's just believe in God and do what he says. And we'll look at the ramifications of that later. Well, let's see what I had to say. That's the closing article in this book, The Very Civil Faith of David Edmund Harold, Jr. I'll wait and show you some of these quotations later on. But, well, let me back that up. That's a quotation from one of my colleagues at Auburn, where I spent my last 15 years teaching. And what Wayne is one of the most distinguished Southern historians in the country. We shared a suite of offices together. And he just said that it was, he knows my faith quite well. And he said it was interesting that it was as if I chose the places where I would teach to demonstrate that you could have faith in God and you could be obedient to him wherever you were. And Wayne says his choice of teaching venue was an attempt to bring to the people he wrote about respectability. Well, I wasn't trying to bring anybody respectability, but I will tell you this, you can be respectable and be faithful to your commitment. Let me just show you this slide. This is one of my history slides, of which, if you got time, I have 800. That about people in the past who have had this same kind of commitment. This is one of the most interesting characters that you would not have heard of. If there's some scientists in the audience, you'll know who Michael Faraday was. Michael Faraday is probably the second most prominent scientist in English language, second to Isaac Newton. He's responsible for all kinds of discoveries in electromagnetism and chemistry. He was twice offered the presidency of the Royal Society in England, which is the most distinguished scientific society in the world. Was given two honorary doctorates from Oxford. He was a lifelong elder in the Church of Christ in London. And when he died, he was offered burial in Westminster Cathedral next to Isaac Newton, and he refused and said he wanted to be buried in the nonconformist cemetery in London of those who were not members of either the Anglican Church or the Catholic Church. I mean, Faraday's just a good example. He's long been an example for me of someone who had a great career, had a great life, but never compromised his faith and obedience to God. And I would just suggest to you that is the way to go. Well, okay, that's another quotation out of the book. So, 82. It's hard to believe I'm 82. I believe in another 10 years I'll be able to shoot my age in golf. But I can tell you, I've had a good life, a full and rich life. One of the people in this book, my friend, who's the chairman of the religion department at Duke, said that I've probably written more than maybe about American religious history than maybe more two people in my lifetime. That's been full. And a lot of people are, I mean, a lot of it's not been any good, but nonetheless, it's a lot. I'll tell you an interesting thing about writing. When you're young, a young scholar, and nobody knows you, you can write some very good stuff. And it's hard to find anybody to publish it. Now I can write junk, and people will publish it. So that is just one measure. But a lot of times people will say, well, boy, you have done a lot, that have no idea that I also held about 25 meetings a year in churches. And I've also played 53 of Golf Digest top-rated golf courses in the world. So life can be full. But I tell you what it has to be. It's the book of Ecclesiastes teaches us, and I think it's Proverbs teaches us, and it's Job teaches us, that you just have to have a single focus. And I've never wavered from that. I believe in God. And have put my trust in Him and made that commitment a long time ago, and it solves a lot of problems. And I intend to obey. And those two things, the writer of Ecclesiastes tells us, are the things that have to be our gyroscope and guide us. If you do that, you won't be the first person that's done that. There are many great historical people who have had full, significant, important lives that were uncompromising in their faith.